For those of you who don't know me, my name is Kron Gibson, and this is Building Healthy Leadership Teams. And that is my obligatory announcement for the recording. And if I could...
He needs the microphone.
If I could get the church planners to quit talking... It is. This isn't a...
I know.
It's a recording mic.
Do you have a microphone?
Handheld. Can you guys hear me if we're not all gregarious? Yes, good. So we're going to go it that way. Okay, so here's my basic presupposition or target, if you will, for what we're going to work on. How many of you guys are actually teaching elders? And how many of you are church planters? Okay. How many of the of you guys that are teaching elders, church planters, experience a whole lot of competing tensions and demands in your role? Yeah, it's just Mark does? Okay, good. Right, so... What we're going to work through today is a basic framework. We are designed for relationship with God, self, and others. And then in the church world, we live in a tension constantly between various systems and their demands on us. The simplest reduction would be organizational and relational systems. An example would be you hire a youth guy. Your wife becomes her or his, you know, best friend, whatever the gender mixes are. But you've got real issues in the organization, and your kids love him. So you need to do something, but you got a train wreck coming in your family and in the relational networks of the church, but you can't lead him. What do you do?
Hire you.
Take it out somewhere else. Nothing.
Nothing. You avoid the task. Perfect. Right. So I just want to sit there because these are the places that we live. I am a teaching elder, for those of you who don't know me. My wife is Elizabeth. She runs a church planting network. We have planted 3 churches, scratch. 2 of them continued. We had to close for family reasons, the third one. I'm also a licensed marriage and family therapist working on my doc in marriage and family therapy. Research targets are about how junk in the leadership systems of the church undermines clergy mental health. And so we're going to be talking, and I'm going to try to give you a different paradigm to think through stuff with today. But we're going to operate out of this foundation that we are created for relationship with God, self, and other. And so that's how I'm going to organize this. We're going to start with what he says. Then we're going to talk about us, and then the problems we all have with others, right? Because none of them have any issues with us. We're just going to talk about others as we go along. But let me pray. Father God, you are good. And you are kind, and the church is yours. Forgive the pride of elder teaching and ruling elders who start to think about the church as theirs. It has never been mine. It has never been ours. It is yours. And yet, Father, in the place you have called us, the pain, the hurts, the tensions, the challenges, they pull at us in a myriad number of ways that often leave us lost, unclear, reactive, in a way that you don't intend for us to have. And so I pray as we talk today, what is from you will stick, what comes from my flesh you'll wash away, that you will not let any of my shortcomings, weaknesses hinder whatever you would like to communicate to all of us today as we walk through the things I've prepared. Holy Spirit, just come and have your way. In Jesus' name, amen. So theological foundation, simply, right? So familiar passages out of Genesis. Then the Lord God said, Genesis 2:18, that it's not good that the man should be alone. I will make a helper fit for him. So I'm just going to sit with the alone. How many of you guys in the ministry have ever felt isolated? Right? And how many of you every morning wake up and pray, I'd love more isolation? It feels so fun in there. Yes. Little irony in the Hebrew language. Any of you guys remember your Hebrew enough to know how the Hebrew word for alone is pronounced? Bad. That's the Hebrew word for alone. Bad. And halet, Hebrew lexicon, it means not connected to, belonging to, or a part of. So God's creational intention for us is to live in a triune relationship, if you will, with Him, ourselves, and other. You ever heard in the church or felt in your own bones that you just need to trust God, or you've heard somebody, you just need to trust Jesus with that, kind of that teaching that leaves you believing harder or better and trapped in isolation? Ever pick that up anywhere? I want to point out that that's exactly not what God said. And we'll even unpack that a little bit in a minute in the life and the ministry of how Jesus went about that. So then the man and his wife were both naked, and they were not ashamed. So I want to hold that. So we are designed for an unhindered, unhidden, unbroken relation with Him, ourself, and others. This is the picture of relationship in creation. We end up, of course, in the fall. And he said, God walks into the garden and says, hey, what's going on? And Adam says, I heard the sound of you in the garden. And I was afraid because, as they say in the Deep South, I was naked. And I hid myself. Now I want to sit in that for a moment and unpack this. The word hid occurs 30 times, the Hebrew word, in the Old Testament. 25 of them out of the fear of death. This is the first one. This picture, here's a feeling. I'm exposed, I'm bad, is what is being communicated here. Because it's the same word, but I'm no longer without shame. I am in shame. Difficult feeling, says belief, something's wrong, not good enough, I'm bad. Behavior, I'm going to hide. Let me reduce that simply for a moment. How many of y'all are married? Any of you ever get defensive or have defensive as your spiritual gift with your spouse?
No.
Never. Okay. I mean, I've never.
She does.
Yes. Yes. I'm a pastor and a therapist. So Elizabeth is still struggling. Right. We've never stopped and said, "Honey, can you slow down? I need to decide if I should be defensive." No. Just give me a minute. I haven't decided. It's not how it works. It does it. Little neuroscience geek for you, if you're reactive, let's call that reactive, the order your brain fires off is difficult feeling, corresponding belief, and a behavior. If you're really activated, like there's something traumatic attached to it, that cycle will move 30 times faster than you can actually think. It just, boom, you're in it. A little high point for you here, modern neuroscience agrees with what God had Moses pen for us a few minutes ago. That is how trauma works in the brain, and you and I are all trauma survivors as perfect attachment with God, self, and other are ruptured, and it's where we live. Now I'm going to hit pause. That was a mouthful. Any questions? Did that make perfect sense? Because Elizabeth says I'm always clear.
I'm slow.
But she's very fast. So is anybody slow and need me to clarify? Did you keep going?
No, say it again.
Okay. The way your brain fires, if you're reactive, and I'm saying this on purpose because you and I live and are doing ministry, whether it's your preaching ministry, you're doing evangelism, networking, building relationships, discipleship, we are living in a trauma-driven culture today, right? That's what I'm trying to connect this to. In the last 3 years, anxiety disorders in the United States are up 400%. Depression is up 400%. Addiction is up 400%. Suicidality is up 400%. Most of you are aware you carry something traumatic in your own story, right? And the way the brain works is whenever anything's activated, difficult feeling, corresponding belief, I'm bad inside, whether that says not good enough, I can't get it right, I can't protect myself, whatever the language of your story says, and a behavior where you mask yourself. Now, those of us that are pastors and elders in here, a humorous example. I was talking to a pastor the other day. He's probably been in the ministry 35 years. We're kind of just chatting with each other, and he was asking about what I do, and I shared a little of this with him. And I go like, would you feel safe sharing stuff with your elders or your session? He started to laugh. I wouldn't even tell him if my knee hurt because of the expectations that would come toward me. Right?
Ron, say the trauma statement coming out of the fall.
We are living in a trauma-driven world. You were all trauma survivors. That's what the text of Genesis is telling you. You were created for intimate relation with God, self, and other. Unhindered and unhidden. Anybody have that? Think about the simpleness of being defensive with somebody. Think of that as a hide behavior. You had a difficult feeling fire off, whether you know it or not. You have a belief attached to it, and you hide. What are places you go hide in the ministry? Netflix?
Busyness.
Work harder.
Try harder.
Stay in your office.
Stay in your office.
Don't talk about yourself.
Yep. Tongue-in-cheek, I'll say to people who present in my office for the first time who are really anxious, because I'm a recovering Yankee and sarcasm is a spiritual gift. I'll say, you know, hey, it's okay to be nervous. Everybody does this. You know, Josh is a friend of mine, so let's just say Josh presents in my office for the first time. We don't know each other. And I go, hey, Josh, brother, it's okay. This is scary for all of us. You kind of metaphorically have to come in and take your clothes off and be revealed. So it's kind of like if you had one of two things to do. You can go out in my lobby. I've got 10 people out there waiting for you. You'll know five of them, and you won't know the other five. And you have to strip emotionally, absolutely butt naked. There's nothing in you get to hide. Anything dark, hidden, shaming, your story, secret sins, let's watch it on a video together. Or you can strip butt naked and take a lap around the office park and come back in. Most part, if we really get honest, we'll say, kill me now, or can I keep my shoes on? Right? Why?
To run.
To run. And I just want you to hold that notion. This is the ministry that you are living in. This is your story. This is my story. When we are unaware of ourselves, we live and we proclaim the gospel of self-defense. Does that make sense to you? We want to build a vulnerable culture so I can share with you as a teaching point. I'm not actually being vulnerable. I'm being transparent. I am not about to let you touch me. Emotional metaphor. So what do we proclaim out of our own shame now that the gospel is? Be better. Try harder. In our hiddenness, my heart believes isolation is life. That's where it is to be safe. I'll be in control. Okay, anybody, let me hit pause. Foundation of what we're doing is important. Does that make sense? Say it again. Ask me a question. Okay. Because this is the ministry you're doing too. We can think about apologetic stuff. Tommy, if some of you were in a seminar yesterday, maybe with Tommy Allen, he was talking about the walls we put up. Like, are you pro-life? Do you vote this way or that way? Well, what do you think about women? Oh, and Jesus is, and after maybe we can get through all the walls, we can talk about Jesus for a minute. But somewhere inside of us, we agree with the walls. I'm not trying to use those specifics. But because we're not engaging Jesus and inviting him into the broken things that we carry, we live with the walls of the trauma of the fall, protesting it and trying to manage its distress all the time. Right? So, now I want to ask you a question. Anybody know the text of Hebrews? We have a high priest who... Mm-hmm. So let's be ministry people together, and let's talk about how Jesus sympathizes for a minute. This is just a quick sample. In Nazareth, Jesus was rejected by the people who knew him. Anyone? Luke 6:6, he's rejected by the religious people for breaking the religious rules. What are you doing healing people on the Sabbath? And let me just hold that one with you for a minute. Let me actually hold this one. And at Simon's house, she cleans his feet. What are the religious rules that you buy that you are supposed to meet because you're in the ministry now that actually trap you away from the work of engagement with real people? What are some of your rules? If you don't know, guess for the person to your right.
Not drinking in public?
Don't drink in public. Yeah. Yeah, that hits you, especially if you're in more of the Southern Baptist community. Right? How together does your family have to be? How much pressure do you put on your children? How good of a parent are you supposed to be? Because if they act out, what are they going to think of me? So here's another religious rule that you're keeping. Because clergy, we agree to be objects, more on again that and again later. Jesus was criticized for the 12 for speaking to the adulterous woman at the well. I planted a church, we called it the well based on this story. Now, so I'm going to touch that one with you. In the Greek text of John, there's a little particle that doesn't often get translated into the English. Dei, D-E-I. That was the original diversity, equity, and inclusion. Never mind. And you watched him work it out. That just totally hit me as a freebie. Okay. Now, but John only uses that word of Jesus. It communicates a sovereign moment of decision. So Jesus sits down in the baking heat of the day. You know the story. And he begins this conversation with the woman at the well. And the guys from the church show back up as he's talking with this whore, this adulterous outsider from Samaria. What do they say to, they don't say directly to him. What do they say to each other? Anybody remember? They're grumbling against their pastor. Why is he talking to her? You shouldn't be in, so the church is the early church plant. It's the first church plant. And they're going, you shouldn't be doing that. And they push against him. You church planters, you ever had any pushback? I mean, guys in the established church, I know it doesn't happen, but you know, right? Okay, people wanted to kill him for being who he was. Now, I've never actually had a death threat. I mean, I was sharing the gospel on the boardwalk in New Jersey once, and a kid pointed a squirt gun at me and said, I'm going to shoot you if you don't shut up. But it wasn't really a death threat, right? Jesus, I love this, if you're into biblical numerology, John 6:66, he's just preached the sermon in which he says, there's only one thing that God requires, believe on him. And all the crowd left him. And he turns to the 12, because Jesus isn't going to move off. Pastor's not moving off the truth. Look what he's doing. He's inviting the honest conversation. This is what it is. Are you guys going to leave? Ever been anxious about saying something hard because they might leave? Right? So I want you to hear the gospel my heart doesn't believe, and then the gospel I do not preach. But we're still talking about God. You know, Jesus had certain cheats, right? He's the God-man. You know, my tongue-in-cheek, I always think about his family, like Mama Mary goes, why can't you be like your brother? Mom, come on, right? Sorrow and isolation. I'm going to go to Gethsemane with you. Matthew 26 is the most familiar in my mind. So Jesus doesn't hide his difficult feelings. I want you to hear perfect faith grants permission to have painful emotions. They're on him. And so Matthew describes him. First, he says he's overwhelmed and distressed. In the next verse, he quotes Jesus. And Jesus actually adds intensifiers. My soul is overwhelmed to the point of death, distressed, grieved unto death. Perfect faith does not mean painful emotions are wrong. Perfect faith lets me hear them and know what they actually mean. Sin and shame hit Adam, and he didn't know what his feelings meant anymore. They were pointing out his loss of connection, his need for to know the Father, to turn back into a place of honesty, to repair with his wife. But he heard them, I'm bad, and he hid. I want you to hear the gospel. Jesus is showing us something of a true gospel-centered life. What are you thinking? What makes you uncomfortable about that?
People don't know what to do with feelings as if you're the leader.
Mm-hmm.
If you're leading and you show feelings, people don't know what to do with you.
Yeah. Because if somebody's with you as a pastor or an elder, right, and they're having difficult feelings, what are you supposed to do? Help them not have them, right? So your job is to preach the law and give them contempt, right?
Well, I think we're suspicious of feelings because we've bred this kind of Gnostic spirituality for so long. So all we've been told is that feelings are only manipulative, are only to be distrusted.
Sure.
And so what you're doing is kind of this paradigm shift around, no, feelings are indicators. They can be...
Right. Perfect, Hunter. So like, so let's hear that. So a little bit tongue-in-cheek, right? Total depravity means sin is marked everything. Correct? We're reformed. We can agree with that for a minute. I'm being recorded. I can mention your name if you disagree just to help. But... So which was more corrupted by the fall, your ability to, your thinking or your feeling?
Yes.
Right. But picking up on what Hunter said, what do we actually do?
Trust a rationality.
Oh yeah. What
I believe my rationality is rational.
Right. We take our mind over our body.
Oh, absolutely.
Yes. What are you going to say?
Oh, no. We trust on a rationality. I mean, more enlightenment.
Yeah.
I think what's fascinating about Matthew 26 is Jesus is modeling proper humanity and healthy neediness. And as pastors, that's something we fundamentally did not deny.
Right. So that's my next word. Thank you, Brandon. 1,000 points for Brandon. Make sure he gets those points later, Elizabeth.
Make sure that's recorded the minute show.
Let the minute show. Brandon got the 1,000 points that don't matter anywhere. Got it? So let's say Brandon and I are friends. Brandon and I are sitting in a coffee shop somewhere, and you're a friend of Brandon's. I've never met you. You walk in, and he goes, "Hey, dude, come sit down. Let me introduce you to my friend Karan. We'll talk for a couple of minutes." And I go, "Hey, you know you're needy, right? How's that sit with you?"
Yes.
Richard, you're needy. Hunter, you're needy. Josh, you're needy. Yeah, Mark's giving me the honest answer. No bueno. So again, what am I saying to my king? I don't need you. In fact, being like you is wrong and bad. So now let's sit in the thinking feeling dimension for a minute. This is actually an artificial split that has embedded itself in culture. Let me get a quick illustration and then touch that. I walk into my closet in the morning and I'm trying to figure out what I want to wear. I'm preferencing. If I can't access my emotional centers, I can't pick what to wear. Something as simple as preferencing requires your cognitive portions of your brain and your emotional portions of your brain. There's a lot of vets from the various wars we've had, and there's been studies done of those who have TBIs in their right brain where the emotions are processed. They can't pick out their clothes. If they have to go to base, they don't have to pick. But if they have to figure out what to wear to something, they can't do it. That's hard-baked design. Okay? Now what we tend to do is we bifurcate these ideas. But actually, if you're going to be whole, they are linked within you. Right? So stereotypically, like how many of you would say you're feelers by your base wiring? Whatever you. Okay, so the other half would say you're thinkers. Right? So the thinker tends to walk into a room and go, "Hey, slow your emotional roll down." Right? And heaps contempt on the feelers. And the feelers, being kind and generous, always just accept the thinker, right? Ha. But what is Jesus doing? Jesus knows his intense feelings, and he actually knows what they mean, thinking. So he's not being reactive. He's in a congruent state. An emotional state has feelings, thinkings, and doings. And what does Jesus do right after he says, "My soul is overwhelmed within me, I'm distressed unto death"? What's the next thing he does? Asks his disciples. He doesn't pray. He hears, he's aware of what it all means. By the way, he was present in Eden when he told somebody else it's not good to be alone. And he says, "Guys, his closest friends, I need you to be with me." And then he prays. I want you to hear something profound right here. This is not where the church lives today. Most of our discipleship, our church planting, coaching, pastor coaching models are quite transactional. We're not doing this part. Those of you who are the church planters or even pastors who've written a plan for your church, does it talk about how to be emotionally whole? How to address this side of the humanity of your own and the people in the room with you? I've never seen one. Doesn't mean they're not out there, but I've never seen one. So we build a church that is based on rejection of something that is fundamental to our humanity. right? And why do we do that? Because I don't like it. I don't want to be needy. Okay, now I'll do it again differently. Again, show me how many of you guys are TEs. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11. All right. You guys ever been hurt by the church? Just that one. It was once. But it was really more like a hangnail. And so you feel safe all the time living presently, right? And I'm not picking on you. You know, if this were a 12-step meeting, I would go, hi, my name is Kron, and I'm in denial about the state of my own human neediness. Right?
Hi, Kron.
Hi. Thank you, Andy. Hi, Kron. I know somebody else like that. Right. Okay. So this is my foundation I want to hold you in. And so let's just kind of unpack, let's just touch this again briefly for us. So put it in different words. So like, everybody says the hurt. We've all experienced rejection. Number one thing we identify often as teaching elders is feeling misunderstood by the people we serve, work with, ruling elders, etc. Feel devalued, isolated, right? So an organizational statement, organizations, the church or ministries are organizations, right? We tend to have this like back row idea, well, this is a Christian ministry, so everything's groovy here. There's a word for that diagnostically. It begins with B and has another word that begins with S. Organizations, churches, and ministries are benign. The organization is benign. It's not good or bad. It's benign. But organizations pursue their bottom line. People become objects needed to produce a chosen outcome. Right? So, pastors become objects. To a lesser extent, ruling elders can experience that. Does that make sense? I was talking to Josh yesterday afternoon. We were just chatting, and he's about 6 months in, really, just getting started, raising his money as a church planter. And you okay if I go here, brother? I should have asked you first. There's a Josh has a big tat. No, okay. My kids used to. It was a joke in our family because I'm in the moment. If you share something about us without asking, you owe me a dollar. And I'm really in debt. So what I decided to do is rack up how much money I spent on them raising them, and I cleaned the table, right? But
my fee's way more than $1.
Okay. Fair enough, my friend. So Josh was articulating to me all these voices he already hears of how he's supposed to function, the pain, blah, 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 expectations from 1,000 different ways, which leaves him as not allowed to be himself, not allowed to lead out of who he is, an object. And so in turn, he's unaware of this. What would he then teach his core team, his leadership, his launch group? Not be themselves. We're all going to be objects. Why don't people share their faith? Because it's not good news. I believe that believers and non-believers are always asking a fundamentally identical question. When I'm doing evangelism, my wife would tell you I cannot not talk about it. People just ask me. I'm on a plane. I tell them what I do, and as soon as they hear the therapist part, they just start talking. Right? But my son said he's going to buy me a t-shirt he saw the other day that I might have to charge you for this conversation. But and I'll just wear it under my shirt. But oh, I totally lost my train of thought there. Evangelism. Thank you so much. Right? Two questions. I'm willing to believe. Will it make any difference if I do? You live in a trauma-driven culture. If you don't know how to enter pain, yours or theirs, and how Jesus actually engages with people, what's the answer? No. But I can help you rearrange the furniture on my, like I have. In a sense, what we say, I know you're dealing with a lot of shame and guilt. I can free you from that and give you Christian shame and guilt as a trade-in. Christians, on the other hand, I believe in Jesus. Why doesn't it make any difference? It's that same question again. Right? And the gospel actually goes here, y'all. we agree to become objects. Now let's push into that one a little. So outcomes of this. Pastors report themselves. This is hard data. Survey of all the United Methodist pastors in Kansas. So there's a couple of them. Data came back across the board. All the pastors reported themselves in better health than the general population. Data says they're all in worse health. A couple of exceptions. Similar study was done in North Carolina, coming out of Duke, right? Just to give you, this is hard stuff they're doing. Same thing. We're not allowed as people in the ministry to say, I'm not okay. If you tell your people you're not okay, what are you afraid would happen? Right. What's the corollary of that? I have to keep my shit together, because my shit being together is what will make this all work. Afraid naked and you're hiding again. Right. In March 2022, 42% of pastors were actively considering leaving the ministry. Stress and isolation are the leading causes. And every time we agree to the stuff I'm talking about, we're fertilizing that for ourselves. We objectify ourselves. Clergy have significant difficulty differentiating themselves from their work. Anybody not identify with that one? 70% of pastors, I bet it's higher, 70% of pastors report a decline in their self-worth as a result of their vocation. MMPI-3 data, some of you are familiar with that. The denomination has started, all new ordinands have to take this. The center I operate, Gospel Center, Counseling Center, we're doing a lot of them. So we have a growing sample I'm going to speak to. So hold what I just said, 70% of clergy, that's completely divorced from what I'm going to tell you. 70% of the clergy we have assessed at this point, one of the measures or scales embedded in the MMPI-3, let me explain that to you. There's 368 questions, and that's all full of measures and scales that cross-pollinate, indicate different things. One of the scales, it's an adjustment scale, indicates how well you engage your difficult feelings, in simple terms. And you can picture these scales like a two-lane highway, emergency lane, and then the ditch. In the language of the MMPI-3, essentially, if you hit the ditch, real pathology is present. 70% of the pastors who have taken this live on the edge of the emergency lane, shutting down their difficult feelings. What do you think that does to us? I mean, think about somebody else, but what does that do to us?
Dehumanizes us.
Mm-hmm.
We become objects.
To find ways to cope.
Find ways to cope. Yep. Enter our other story. I've got to fix this shame and woundedness, so clearly addiction or something else is better, right?
Depression, anxiety,
right?
Addiction.
Yep. A little neuroscience and design. So every addiction out there right now, that whether it's a chemical like coke or alcohol, or what we call a process addiction like shopping or gambling, so no overt chemistry involved. They all go right through a pathway in your brain that activates dopamine, okay? When I feel safe with somebody or I'm struggling and Elizabeth says, honey, are you okay, and hugs me, guess what my brain secretes? Right. So all of these things we're turning to are hijacking the biological, this is biblical anthropology actually, how God biologically designed us. Jesus comes out of the garden and they're asleep. Anybody remember top of your head what he says to them? For one hour, could you not be with me? We understand that, but also in our own stories, because of our stories, we don't give that very well either. I kind of tongue-in-cheek say, like, if something happened to Elizabeth and she died, I figure I've got like 2 weeks in the local church to grieve before people start wondering why I'm not getting better and believing Jesus better. Right?
You get 2 weeks.
Well, yeah, if I pay for it. Right. Okay. Unpublished qualitative data. I'm working on my doc, as I said, and I ran my own qualitative study And so I tell you the sample in there of where they were coming from. And as if you're not familiar with research language, qualitative is like an interview. And it's scripted and structured, and then you mark it to find themes that are running through, that are running in parallel. And when you have enough samples or people in it, you exhaust, new themes aren't popping up. So qualitative study samples are often quite small because you hit what we call saturation, okay? I hit saturation with less than 6 people related to the experience of shame in the church, the attitudes, actions, behaviors, and words toward them and their work in the local church. Now, the female reported it as, I was just the girl in the room. The African American reported it as, these white guys said, I'm the black guy, they don't want to help. One was a planter, one was an established church pastor, described the exact same thing, but we've bought it, it's this, it's that, it's this, it's not. Different mechanisms, but it's this. You're an object. And you're dismissed because you're pushing from outside something. And all the stuff that we're talking about in our culture, much less pastor burnout rates, is this. Pause again. Thoughts, comments, questions? Richard. I'm sorry, say again. More the general population? I asked my associate, who actually is running the data on the test, that question. He didn't give me that number, but he said, we've got enough data growing here. Pearson is the one who owns the MMPI-3 that you get it from. That he said, he thinks when we hit about 30, we can actually pursue Pearson to create a subgroup, because our data is so different. I don't know what the number was. But another side of that, I've got a lot of, I'm not counting my, coffee cup counseling when I'm pastoring churches and different things. So actually just kind of sitting in the clinical chair, if you will. I have about 22,000 hours of experience with people, families. And in principle, come back to Richard's question, people struggling with depression, anxiety, it's all this all the time. It is the protest against attachment ruptures. And I know all of you have a book at home called The Diagnostic and Statistical Manual 5. I just read, Meredith and I have exchanged some emails. Meredith's a counselor. You probably keep yours in the bathroom for evening reading. Right, yeah. I mean, it's like, let's pick up some tax code and find something worthless. That's a sidebar. But in the kind of apparatus of diagnostics, unless you're dealing with a true biologic, meaning like schizophrenia, for example, this, what I'm talking to you about, underpins every diagnosis. And God's talking about it with us. We have something to speak to the world about, to give. But pastor as self, elder as self, I invite you to go, am I willing to let Jesus give it to me? Again, if we're honest, it's like, no, because that's terrifying. And so we keep asking the same question, I believe, why doesn't it make any difference? Or, this is a pet peeve, you guys all have probably Christian counseling centers around you, and they advertise Christian counseling. If you go in and you interview most Christian counselors, tell me how the gospel touches what you're doing. Tell me about your view of the church. Tell me how theology informs your life and what you understand and how it comes into play. It's just not there. Data point again. I have a couple of papers on my hard drive. A guy from Duke, he was assistant chair, may still be, of the psychiatry department at Duke Medical. In other words, this isn't like Pastor Cron came up with some numbers, right? I think his last name is Koenig. He commissioned a literature review from 1880 to 2013, looking at what you could think of as treatment as usual. So let's just sit and do counseling. Let's do group therapy. Why don't you take Prozac when that became available? treatment as usual, versus what he calls spiritual interventions, where the therapist's religious framework matches the client's. What do you think the outcome differential is?
Almost nothing.
Wrong. Depression, anxiety, addiction, PTSD, you hit all the big ones. Anywhere from 40 to 70% more efficacious. This is hard data. Ask your Christian counselor if they've ever been taught that and trained how to bring gospel into the room. When you refer, you're teaching people to bifurcate often mental health and faith or Jesus in their heart and mind. Well intended. I'm just telling you. And I can tell you that I have clinicians who work for me from six different Christian universities, and they would all go, that's absolutely the truth. That was a freebie. Okay, so. Oh, crap. Guys, can you stay here till 2? Okay. Let me high point some stuff. I didn't realize what time it is. This was the first pass at this seminar, and I have now learned things. What I'm trying to give you here is just a quick picture for yourself, right? What are your two greatest needs? What are people's two greatest needs? Research statement. I'm just going to cliff note going forward. Two greatest needs are purpose and belonging. So let's see that in creation. It's not good for you to be alone. Created to have belonging. And what was his charge? Purpose, to be fruitful and multiply, dominion. Hard-baked design. Belonging and purpose. Your people, you're doing evangelism, your launch team, maybe actually you and me. This is what's under everything. And I want to prod you to start thinking about what's happening with your people and with you and the people you're trying to reach. These are the two things. I could throw you all kinds of research data. It's much easier if I just say it agrees with Jesus. Okay? So what happens in most of our models then, we have a cause and effect view of change that is transactional. Stop doing that. Do this. Right? But actually what the data is more and more showing is even in a relationship like Elizabeth and I are in a moment of conflict, where the language is we co-regulate. We live in a system with each other. She's annoyed, so I get defensive or whatever, right? And we do this accelerating thing. But why? Because we don't want to talk about I feel insecure inside. We want to say you're doing. Or it's not safe for me to say. Can you hear that in your church and even in your groups, your launch teams and other places, your sessions? We don't talk about this part. And so here's it's called circular causality instead of linear. It's trying to describe interactive systems. So here's just a picture for it. So this was an actual image, right? And if any one of them moves, what's going to happen? Collapse. Right. So it's a picture. The pull of this developed system is to maintain and not change. So you can think about a church, whether it's a church plant or an established church. We got to figure out how to keep everything okay. And so we hold what becomes a dysfunctional homeostasis as we balance it. And the system development is a reliable, because it's reliable. I don't want to name what's happening. Like the language of a non-anxious presence. I appreciate it, and it's wrong. I want to pick on my friend Richard. Right, Richard, you ever been anxious? I mean, I never have, but have you been anxious?
Yeah, like right now.
Okay, yeah. Thank you. I knew I could help you with that. Right? So what I want you to do right now, yeah, what I want you to do right now is have a non-anxious presence. Yeah. Who else in your launch team is concerned or anxious? Is there going to be something for my kids? Is this going to work? But we're not going to talk about being anxious, are we? Or the pressure I feel as the planter. So I want you to hear how we're agreeing to maintain a dysfunctional status quo that Jesus isn't preaching to us, nor is Jesus modeling to us, and how he did ministry. And so we get stuck here. We know an evangelism training course. Now that helps. I interviewed at a church years ago. We really want you to come and be here because I can't not share my faith. I'm an old Campus Crusade guy. I can't not do it. You know, because we really want change. We want this. Like, well, tell me about outreach. I'm with a pulpit committee. Well, we've had 3 evangelism courses through our church in the last 6 years. That's fantastic. Tell me about how any of you have shared your faith. We've had 3 evangelism courses. All right, so let me ask you another question. How many of you have had another person, maybe a mentor or a disciple, or go, hey, let's go do evangelism today? And actually go walk out and meet people. Take you to follow up and be with, not train and say do. See, system, transaction. And we stay stuck. First order change is that transaction. I want to get you to do something. Or you think about giving. Anybody ever here feel challenged in the last year in your church or ministry financially? Just one time? As long as that's a continuous time? And you start thinking, how do I get them to give or sign up or join? Right? Transactions. We're missing something. Second order change is when we get to what's underneath it and we're addressing inside out what's happening. And I want you to think about how Jesus is doing that all the time. 94% of millennials want to use their skills to benefit a cause, belonging, and purpose. People don't just love their jobs because of what they do. They love it because of why they do it and how they feel when they do it at work. That paragraph goes on and talks about the withness of it all. You and I are leading volunteer organizations. I don't have a 401k sharing plan for my church members. What do I have to give them? Relationship and partnership and meaning. But if I won't address my insecurity and my own need to have it work out, what do I create? So I'll just stop on this one. So I invite you to sit down, whether established church or your church plant, and go, most of you have probably developed some form of strategic plan. 1 year, 3 year, 5 year kind of an idea. And it kind of gives you some metrics, or your coaches are pushing metrics, or your elders are going, we need to get metrics going, right? Are you paying attention to this part? When people understand, they get the present hope of the gospel, but that they are loved, that they seen, that they matter, their voices are heard, they have good news to give away, and then I get to train them because they're already doing it. But this is painful, and it requires things of me that I feel much safer over here not doing. But again, I want you to watch what Jesus does. Simple language, and I'm done. Come, follow me, and what? Make you fishers of men. And then how does he do it? Simple, real quick. He walks with them. He's present with them. He says hard things to them. He tells them he needs them. He shows them things. He models a life of faith risk with them. He doesn't tell them to go have a faith risk. That's actually biblical discipleship. Discipleship without evangelism is not biblical. These are not two different ideas. Biblical discipleship always has evangelism. But if I understand what the King has done for me, but if I see and I learn the present hope in the turmoil of soul, get out of the way. Because I need to tell somebody what's happened. So this was a first pass at it. I've got a bunch of business cards I'm thinking about if you're interested. But I haven't gotten real far on this. I'll give you a card. Shoot me an email. I've thought about doing like a once a month online cohort, maybe sometime over the next year, ministry in a trauma-driven culture or something along those lines, to walk that out with our own story and the work we're doing. So if you want a card, come grab me after. And thanks, guys.